Hello and welcome to The Climate Clinic, a podcast brought to you by the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education. My name is Adesh Sundaresan, and I'm a doctor from University College London. In this series, Be the Expert, I'll be joined weekly by my co-host, Dr. Mark Futenik, an emergency physician from Los Angeles. Each week, Mark and I will bring you the latest headlines from climate and health research from the leading evidence-based journals from around the world. Tune in to learn about the health implications of climate change, how this is affecting us today, and what needs to be done. By the end of it, you'll know all you need to know in order to be the expert. Welcome back to episode 13 of Be the Expert with myself, Adesh Sundaresan, and Dr. Mark Futenik. Mark, we're continuing on our theme looking at drought, water scarcity, and human health. What do we have for our listeners today?
Adesh, I'm really excited for this topic today because it hits home for me living in Southern California. And I love how they framed it as an ancient problem, which of course it is. Water availability has been an essential factor for urban growth ever since the beginning of civilization. So this article was published in the British Medical Journal in October of 2020. And I was glad, Adesh, that you handled last episode's authors, by the way. This commentary is titled Protecting Health in Dry Cities, Considerations for Policymakers, which was authored by Howard Frumkin, Maitreyi Bordia Das, Maya Negev, Brioni Rogers, Roberto Bertolini, Carlos Dora, and Sonalde Desai. And to highlight why this is such an important topic, currently the majority of people in the world live in urban environments. More than 55% even of the global population. And in some countries, such as the UK, where Adesh lives, it's expected that more than 90% of the population will be living in cities by 2050, which is not that far off. The reasons why some cities can be permanently dry or short of water are logical. Could be their location in an arid environment with low precipitation, or low fresh water availability, such as depleted water table in the area, or a combination of these that are then pushed by increasing demand as the population grows. And the authors inform us that an estimated 150 million people right now live in cities that have perennial water shortages, such as desert cities like Doha in Qatar, Abu Dhabi, Cairo, Windhoek in Namibia, Antofagasta in Chile, Trujillo in Peru, and Las Vegas and Phoenix in the United States. Other cities are dry because of temporary scarcity or drought. Semi-arid cities can become dry if drought strikes, or if demand grows faster than supply, or if the city just can't keep pace owing to poor governance or inadequate infrastructure. And some examples of these cities are Cape Town, which has recently hit a serious problem, and Gaborone. Others such as Chennai, India, which Adesh talked about in our previous episode on drought, have historically had enough water, but recently are confronted with real scarcity. And others such as LA and Bangalore are predicted to fall short in the coming years. I was surprised to hear that LA was not really considered a city facing drought currently, considering that we have water restrictions and it is a constant topic of discussion. But it just shows how much worse off so many other places are already.
Yeah, really important point there, Mark, is that even with London in summer, we had a relative water shortage, we had hose pipe bans and water use restrictions as well throughout the summer last year. But I think it was really, as I mentioned in the previous episode, I realized what it was to be in a city where there was just no groundwater when I went to Chennai in 2019, and there was just a day zero where there was just nothing available, you know. And this is the irony: was there's an abundance of salinated water. It's a coastal city, but just no available fresh drinking water for people living there. So this article is structured in a similar fashion to the previous review that we talked about, Mark. The authors initially looked to define what we mean by a healthy, dry city. They then set the context for this discussion, link some of the challenges of living in these dry cities that you've described to climate change. They then look at the specific health issues in these cities related to drought, including infectious diseases, non-communicable diseases, mental health, violence and conflict, and child development. And finally, they go on to explore how we can conserve and promote our health in these dry cities. The authors re-emphasize the importance of water availability in our cities and urban environments, using COVID as an example. So just to fulfill something as basic as our hand hygiene and disease containment, we need water to wash our hands. All cities share health challenges, but dry cities have some unique challenges as climate change and water scarcity worsen rising heat and propel the diseases that are found in hot climates. So let's start off by the definition. So they define a healthy dry city as one which manages its physical and social environments when water is scarce to optimize the health and well-being of all of its inhabitants. So it's a simple enough definition, Mark. They also explain that healthy dry cities are achievable with the right policies and institutions and with a space for innovation too.
Certainly seems a worthy goal to become a healthy dry city. So I want to quickly comment on figure one in this article. It compared the growth of urbanization by world region since 1950 and then projects the trends out until 2050. It was pretty eye-opening. So although in absolute percentages, North America, Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean currently have the highest rates of urbanization, over 80%, for instance, in Europe, versus something like mid-40s for Africa and Asia. But the fastest growth in urbanization is seen in those latter regions. In 1950, less than 20% of the global population were urban dwellers. And by 2050, we can expect at least 60%. So that's a tripling in that 100 years. And so much of this urban growth will take place in arid regions. With growth in demand for water exceeding the growth in supply, the number of people living in cities with perennial water shortage is projected to reach almost 1 billion by 2050. 1 billion. And migration will be a key driver of urbanization and is driven by factors such as drought and also natural disasters, and another factor such as the salination of our fresh water that's occurring more and more in lowland areas. And this migration will put pressure on cities that are already water scarce. Another issue that exacerbates the health impacts of people in the urban areas is the high level of inequality that exists within these cities. The authors state that almost one quarter of the world's urban population, so more than a billion people, live in informal dwellings, which really means slums or tent cities. Back in 2018 is when that was established. Most of these are in Africa and Asia. And we've discussed on previous episode, in episode 9, how slums are associated with poor water availability and quality, poor sanitation, and that the inhabitants have higher rates of death and disease.
Mark, the authors also note that climate change amplifies the challenges of these dry cities in at least two ways, as we've covered in the previous episode. First, by reducing the availability of water, and secondly, by increasing heat.
So it's just logical that you need water when it's hot. So the combination of heat and drought are cumulative. And keep in mind that our main natural mechanism of cooling when it's dry and hot requires lots of water to evaporate the sweat, which we excrete from our skin.
Absolutely. This is a multiplicative effect from, as you said, increased heat, increased evapotranspiration, and also the lack of water availability too. Dry weather can also be punctuated by sudden bursts of heavy rainfall, a well-recognized phenomenon in arid regions, which you also delineated in our last episode, Mark, and talked about. Urban dwellers are also subject to a variety of environmental hazards. So these are, we've covered these in detail before, but air pollution, high waste, green and blue space deprivation, lax environmental controls in rapidly industrializing countries. And there's often a double burden on health of city dwellers, especially in lower middle income countries, characterized by coexistence of infectious diseases such as HIV and AIDS, TB, pneumonia, dengue, diarrhea, and high rates of non-communicable diseases now as well. And many of these infectious diseases thrive in hot cities when the water is scarce. So unfortunately, it falls on these cities to prepare for diseases of both richer and poorer context.
Yeah, so the authors then move on to exploring the specific health issues in these dry cities. Many of these climate-driven health outcomes we've covered in previous reviews, so we won't necessarily repeat them all, but we'll add in some of the additional points. An interesting one is that there is evidence linking high temperatures with aggressive behavior and violent crime and even death by suicide. Societal tension can escalate into armed conflict, and several of these dry cities are in areas with already fragile political situations. The article mentioned the links between water scarcity and armed conflict are controversial, but I think it's okay to use a little bit of logic here. When clean water, an essential ingredient for survival, becomes scarce, humans will fight for it. It is already delivered via armed convoy in some of these desert areas, so we know where this is headed. Armed conflict, of course, negatively impacts the health of both combatants and civilians in many ways, so this is a serious concern. In the previous study, the authors touch on how droughts can affect child development from poor nutrition due to reduced agricultural output and disrupted education. And in this article, the authors raise the idea that when water is scarce, parents might provide children with sweetened or sugary drinks instead of water, thereby increasing the rates of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. And they even cited a study where they gave kids in school reusable water bottles and installed filtered water drinking fountains at school, and then studied them. And lo and behold, they drank more water. Not that amazing. But the amazing part is that they lowered their risk of being overweight by 31%, an astounding figure. And I'll just say, I suspect this would work for adults too, Adesh. So we've talked about the health impacts of drought for a couple of episodes. How can we promote health in these dry cities?
That is an example of such a straightforward but effective solution, Mark, for children. And I suppose, as you said, I can surmise that the same would probably work for adults. I think you're right on that one. So the authors divide their solution section into 7 mini segments. And we're going to talk through these in brief detail as we go through the next few minutes. So the first of these solution sections looks at resilience within health systems. For example, health infrastructure and equipment should be adapted to drier and hotter conditions. Health workforce should be trained for morbidity exacerbated by drought. And health information systems should be timely. They need to include drought-related health indicators, and accessible healthcare needs to be provided for inhabitants. Secondly, they come on to looking at urban governance strategies. So they suggest that decentralization permits cities to raise their own resources, plan and implement policies. Another interesting point they make with regards to governance is that good urban governance should place accountability to its residents, with city governments making information freely and publicly available, investing in public education and strengthening the citizens' voice as well. You know, civil society has a critical role in urban governments, particularly in facilitating the government-citizen collaboration as well. NGOs are often also service providers and policy analysts as well, and advocates. Finally, cities can provide help and incentives for innovations led by non-state personnel. These could be citizens groups and the private sector too, and corporations. There are good models for urban water and health governance, but very few examples in the context of dry urban governance. And we need more examples of these for people to be able to share around, duplicate and replicate successfully.
Yeah, this is actually really complicated stuff. So the authors then look at solutions to improve clean water supply and manage the increasing demand. And they sort of simplify it into 3 things that we can do. We can recycle our wastewater. We can collect and manage water better, mostly rainwater, and then the snow melt that comes later in the year. And then desalination of salt water. So we'll start with, they cited the example of Melbourne in Australia, which was able to recycle more than 20% of its wastewater in 2010, which really is great, but that provided only a few percent of its annual freshwater demand. So it's certainly a benefit, but maybe doesn't solve the problem in the big picture. Then there's storage options such as aquifer recharge efforts, rainwater tanks that retain water for later use during dry period. This can be done sort of at the city level or at the national level, but also on the individual level with people having rain barrels and such. And then desalination has been an important tool for many of these dry cities, but it also has real disadvantages. It requires large amounts of energy, which currently often comes from fossil fuels. which is also very expensive, produces large quantities of brine and other toxic byproducts. It removes iodide from the seawater, which may contribute to deficiency disorders, and typically requires a lot of valuable water-adjacent terrain. They also propose solutions related to regional approaches, often involving legal and administrative efforts, that help to manage the distribution of water resources between competing sectors, such as the battles between rural and agricultural uses, and then large urban growing populations, and then also even environmentalists who may push for other uses entirely, like to support wildlife in areas that have become dry. The authors mentioned Arizona specifically when alluding to these politics of water, but they didn't get into the specifics, but I will for a second, because this is where I live. The Colorado River is the dominant fresh water supply to four states, including the southern part of California, where I live, and the battles over this water are historic, going on for 100 years now, complex, ongoing, and many fear absolutely unsolvable. There's simply not enough water for all the needs, because it supplies drinking water to very large population centers, LA being the second largest city in the United States, as well as water for irrigating crops throughout those four states. And obviously, those are essential for the economy of these areas. So really difficult situation we're facing.
Really important points that you've touched on there, Mark, as well. They also move on to looking at vulnerability and risk assessments to identify hotspots and help prioritize the resources that we have, as well as public health messaging campaigns to raise awareness and promote behavior change amongst urban dwellers. So these could include useful and possibly what we might consider to be very logical, but not necessarily for everyone might have the awareness around it, but avoiding outdoor exertion during hot times of the day, carrying water, keeping hydrated, being alert to the signs of dehydration and hyperthermia, and also about not wasting water. So water conservation measures, taking shorter showers, collecting and reusing water, and so on and so forth.
Hey, Desh, I want to raise a point that they didn't specifically mention, which is that some large corporations have been buying water sources, literally buying the land and the water rights where the water is collected or pumped in order to sell bottled drinking water. And this practice has become increasingly common, leading to water inequity. It's also being increasingly challenged legally, but we shouldn't have to sue to keep water in the public domain.
It astounds me that this is just not something that is freely available for people.
Yeah, it highlights for me, you know, many of the things that we've been talking about, what the basic essential functions should be of our government. And they're involved in so many aspects of our lives, but it really should start with supplying clean water and providing sanitation so that people can then, you know, establish their own clean, healthy, secure lives.
Absolutely, Mark. And it's an interesting point, which I was a discussion I was having with Dr. Stefan Wheat, who's based up in Seattle very recently, when, you know, he made a very good point to say, until basic human needs are met, including food availability, water, hygiene availability, there can't be a platform for many human beings around the world to consider climate change and its interactions with health until these needs are met. So they are very closely linked, Mark. Lastly, they briefly mentioned nature-based interventions. So these are street trees, vegetation, green space, and green technology. So these are constructed wetlands and biofilters that can help to cool urban microclimates, reduce this evapotranspiration, as well as control stormwater pollution and flows too. There are some trade-offs though. Trees will provide shade and reduce the demand on air conditioning, but then they also demand more water themselves for their survival. So in summary, Mark, these were the key recommendations that the authors made. Number one, we need to strengthen our health systems in dry, hot climates, including their ability to engage in multi-sectoral adaptation planning. Two, we need to develop national policies that give greater autonomy to cities, policies in dry cities that build systems that are inclusive, transparent, and accountable to residents. Third, invest in better management of water resources, including better technology and the management of demand and supply. Four, invest in better tools and diagnostics to guide water system management. 5, develop effective social marketing, which can really drive changes in public behavior, promote protecting health and conserving water simultaneously. And finally, the fact that we need to invest in nature-based solutions. We've had a whole podcast on this, how important this is, to provide the foundations for sustainability and well-being.
You know, Adesh, it's clear to me from our recent discussions of urbanization's risk on human health, including this one about drought, that we're in a similar situation to when we first started urbanizing. And we need to build the infrastructure to match the population's demands. We need water, food, energy, transportation corridors, clean air, secure shelter, waste management, as we always have. But now we better understand the challenges involved in making these things accessible in a safe and affordable way for really large populations. We need clean air, safe drinking water, renewable energy, sanitation measures for people living on the margin as well, safe and efficient public transportation. We need to prepare for many more people to migrate into these same cities, as well as planning new ones from scratch.
Great summary there, Mark, and very enjoyable article to go through. Very important topic, crucial. We hope you enjoyed this. Mark, as always, absolute pleasure recording with you. Hope to see you all back soon for the next episode of Be The Expert. Thank you and goodbye.